This is David Green. I am co-founder of Fearless Media and your host here on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we take on all the political issues, even the complicated ones that might be dividing your own family these days, and we try to understand the issues from all sides. Well, President Biden is on the offensive. As a first-term president with weak approval ratings, history says his party will get throttled in these midterms, so maybe he feels like he has nothing to lose here. He gave several campaign-style speeches in Pennsylvania this week, culminating with one primetime on Thursday night in Philadelphia. It was full of symbolism. He was speaking right outside Independence Hall. Biden argued that Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans, a phrase he used quite often in the speech, are trying to turn our country backwards. He said they don't respect the Constitution, that they support angry mobs and support stopping peaceful transfers of power. Biden went on to say that blind loyalty to a single leader and willingness to engage in political violence is fatal to democracy. The president sure seems to be trying to put himself and Donald Trump and the stakes for democracy all at the center of these midterms now. It is a risky strategy, we have to say, given Trump's support and given the danger that some Republican voters could feel judged and attacked by the president. But it also may frame where we go from here this fall, for better or worse, for Democrats. So let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. I'm your host in your center on the left. We have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. And on the right, we have Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. So, Liz, let me ask you about Biden's Philadelphia moment Thursday night. I mean, primetime address, billed as a speech about the soul of democracy. Biden called this an inflection point when Americans really have to decide their course. I mean, did the speech live up to sort of what the expectations were?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, it echoed the language that Democrats have been using for a long time about the Trump presidency. It developed this new, categorization for people who are hardcore supporters of Trump, MAGA Americans, Make America Great Again Americans, which is sort of a weird phrase when you spell it out. But this is the core of people that Biden is addressing with this speech and sort of presenting as the antagonist to American democracy. And I imagine that these are the people who supported or continue to support Trump, despite, I think, what Democrats fairly consider pretty damning evidence that's come forth during the January 6th hearings and even just, kind of regular security concerns that have arisen since, having to do with the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, et cetera. I think, Biden is making some, valid points in consideration of that information. I also think it's just a very kind of historically poignant thing, an American president sort of pleading with the American citizenry to take peaceful transfers of power seriously. And, I don't think we should read too much into January 6th. I think there's a point at which, one can see too much risk there, can say that we were too close to the government toppling or something like that. I think that's blowing things somewhat out of proportion. But, that is an example of political violence, threatening our tradition of peaceful transfers of power. And, we don't want civil unrest to be something that accompanies every single transfer of power. That's not healthy for a democracy. And so, to the degree that Biden was trying to address that worrying symptom, I think it was a significant speech.
Tim, I mean, did you see this as significant? And should Republicans be worried that Biden is coming out fighting now on these kind of big, weighty, historic questions?
There's two aspects to that question. One is, I was there on January 6th, and it was absolutely insane. And there were people who were nuts, who believed in crazy conspiracy theories, who I was interviewing, who were trying to stop Biden from being certified as a winner of the election, even though he was the winner of the election. That's extraordinary. September 1st is the beginning of the campaign season, and that's the other hand of this story. This was a typical political speech. Biden is trying to position the Democrats, not just says, oh, we're the party that sticks up for what you believe in, but we're the only party that's legitimate in this democracy. And while that's kind of radical extreme stuff, and Biden's delivering it with this like red background and U.S. Marines behind him, and you've got the Tom Edsel, this great columnist writing, oh, if the Republicans win in Florida, et cetera, the democracy has lost. On one hand, it's just regular old politics. And on that level, I just want to yawn. Yeah, okay, fine. You think if the other side wins, democracy loses. Okay, Trump was extraordinarily bad. Trump is not on the ballot in 2022. And what Biden is trying to do is take the worst aspects of Trump and Trumpism and apply it to every Republican and all the way down to the random member of Congress. I don't think that's great for democracy, but you know what? I'm used to Democrats doing normal stuff like that, just like Republicans
do. Isn't there a delusional aspect to when Biden said there are a lot of reasonable Republicans who he could be talking to? And you seem to maybe even share in that thinking that there's a sizable part of the Republican Party that is reasonable. I mean, Biden basically saying like Trump has taken over the Republican Party. It is really scary. And this is a scary moment for our country. Like what is not true about that?
Well, Trump has too much control over the Republican Party. But when you go ahead and say Ron DeSantis is anti-democratic, what you're saying is, I don't like people who are conservative. And that's what Biden is going ahead and doing. And he lumped pro-lifers. He said people who are against democracy and against Roe v. Wade. Come on. Roe v. Wade is undemocratic by definition. So, like, you can battle us on abortion and Roe v. Wade, or you can say that our side is inherently democratic. You can't do both at the same time. Donald Trump is a plague on this country, and it is in Joe Biden's interest to try to lump everybody who is to the right of Anderson Cooper into the same pile as Donald Trump. So somebody cares about democracy, and it's not the guy who's saying that 47% of this country hates democracy.
So I think I can be helpful here as a referee because I don't care about either party and am unwanted and a refuge from each, being, you know, a sort of person of the left. It seemed to me that Biden was actually at pains to say, you know, there are good Republicans. And in fact, to characterize even the vast majority of them as the sort of mainstream and even dominant Republicans in order to try to escape the charge, perhaps, of saying Democrats equal democracy in the American future and Republicans of every stripe and kind in every case equal, you know, fascismo, right? I mean, I think he was really kind of taking great pains to avoid that. For that exact reason, because, you know, it seems to me that he is actually kind of perturbed for what it's worth over the peaceful transfers of power issue. That doesn't mean that there is not, a secondary campaign motive. I think it's clear to everybody when they're ringing the Liberty Bell and bringing out the Democratic president September 1st in a midterm election year. Yeah, it's obviously a campaign speech. And so he's clearly stumping for the Democrats and saying he's done so much for this country and he wants to bring back the, you know, unified American spirit, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't mean that what he's saying about this sort of radical core of people who, are sort of committed to civil unrest around elections isn't true.
Well, let me ask you both that. I mean, I the big risk to me in this speech was that Biden decided to just label people. And I mean, I agree with you, Liz, like he made room for there being, you know, reasonable Republicans. I don't think he was saying that every Republican is, you know, is a MAGA Republican, but it just didn't even seem to put out the welcome mat for people. Like if they wanted to think about this speech and say, gosh, like I voted for Donald Trump, I don't agree with what happened on January 6th. You know, maybe I want to think about supporting different candidates, maybe come to Joe Biden. Like it didn't feel like the welcome mat was there at all. And isn't that a dangerous move from this president?
It's an unusual move from this president precisely because Biden likes to present himself as a creature of the Senate who works well with folks across the aisle and has had many long-term friendships with people who are Republicans. But I think at this point, Tim is correct to say he's trying to do his best to sort of pump up support for the Dems and really emphasize some of the differences between the worst aspects of the Republican Party and the best aspects of the Democratic Party.
I was just going to say, let me give you an example of why this doesn't work. Because in 2016, it comes out the audio that Donald Trump likes to sexually assault women, right? Remember the grab them by the hoo-ha
right.
audio.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that Barack Obama and the Democratic Party reacted to that was rather than simply drive Trump into the ground, Obama went to Ohio and he said, all the Republicans are like this, including Senator Rob Portman. There is nobody who is less grab them by the hoo-ha in the history of the U.S. Senate than Senator Rob Portman.
Did he really lump Portman into that directly? I mean, I don't remember
He absolutely did. And he went ahead and I remember I was following it exactly. And he said, all the Republicans are this way. And he said, Trump didn't build this. The Republicans built it. Trump just slapped his name on it. That was beautiful. That was beautiful rhetoric by Obama. Like, he was a brilliant rhetorician. But his whole thing was to say there's no difference between Rob Portman and Donald Trump. And guess what happened? In the state that Rob Portman carried easily, Donald Trump ended up winning. So I'm just going to say, if you Democrats listening, just from your own partisanship, you should not want there to be a blending of the MAGA Republicans and everybody who happens to be pro-life or conservative. And I just felt like Biden said there are some fine Republicans, but if you're pro-life, if you're conservative, you get thrown into that extreme MAGA minority. That's their strategy. They think this will work. They think that Trump will be the millstone that will drag down every Republican, and maybe he will. But maybe it'll make people say, huh, if extreme MAGA Republican means I'm pro-life or means that I think the government shouldn't go ahead and, like, on the whim have an executive thing to bail out a bunch of college graduates, well, that might actually have the opposite effect of what Biden think it'll have.
Liz, are you worried about this? I mean, you know, Biden could not have said more emphatically, we are the United States of America at the end of this speech. But couldn't you see this as a divisive speech by kind of labeling a segment of our country and saying you people believe in terrible things and want our democracy to crumble?
I mean, yeah, that did occur to me. I mean, and I could see even as Biden was laying down all this track, it's going to immediately be subsumed by the exact things that Tim is pointing to, on some level, we've heard all this rhetoric before, that the January 6th stuff has been going on for so long that it's just sort of been exhausted in the media, that we've had, you know, 5+ years now of cogitating on Trump and everything he represents and all the risks and so on and so forth. And there's just a limit to what people are willing to listen to and tolerate on that front. For all those reasons, I could just hear the right-wing media, you know, just sort of chewing it up and spitting it out. I doubt it's going to land with the people it needs to land with. And the reality is, you know, there are a certain number of people in the United States, and I don't know if there's 100% overlap with MAGA Americans here, who are, you know, genuinely sort of disillusioned with, disenchanted with, you might say, American democracy. And American democracy, it relies on us being enchanted with it to exist. And in some sense, enchanted with the idea of America and enchanted with one another. And if we stop feeling that way, it's a vibes-based entity. And at that point, it dissolves. That's when you see political violence around elections. That's when you see, you know, election workers being threatened and so on and so forth. That's people no longer being in the mood for democracy, no longer being willing to put in the emotional labor that it takes to live in a democracy, such as controlling yourself when you don't get your way. That's a big piece of it. And so I do think as Americans, we all need to, regardless of our party affiliation, or in my case, lack of one, recommit ourselves to these values, because I think it would suck to live in a country where we had permanent civil unrest and political violence.
Well, I want to, Tim, let me ask you about that, because listening to Liz, I realize like where my heart is. Like I can see this as a campaign style speech and a really risky strategy. And I really wish Biden would have created a space for Republicans who don't really, who feel attacked by the label, like to come back and find a home with this president or with a more moderate arm of their party or the Democrats. And September 1st, of course, this is the kind of speech that a president's going to give in a midterm election that's not looking good for his party, frankly. But I just wonder, like, if I'm reading a history book a century from now and reading about, like, you know, broadly where a country is, I kind of wonder, like, is this the speech that I would have wanted my president to give in this moment?
This is not the speech Abraham Lincoln would have given in this moment. And I mean, so especially the fact that the Democrats have a problem, which is that abortion and the culture wars really are a tail that's wagging the dog. And there is a Democratic Party in sort of in our imagination that could just say, look, you might not agree with us on, you might be basically fiscally conservative, or you might be like a Christian, a Catholic who goes to church every Sunday and is pro-life. But like, Donald Trump is a leader of your party, Republicans, and he tried to overturn the election because all he cares about is himself. So just to return your own party to sanity and to what you supposedly believe in, like, let's vote these guys out and let's start in Pennsylvania with Dr. Oz and Mastriano. And, you know, you could go and really pick off a few guys. Biden feels constrained to do that because he feels constrained to stand on this sort of extreme culture war left side of his party. And just, you could imagine Mario Cuomo or somebody else a couple decades ago when the Democrats weren't so beholden to the extreme left of making a pitch. And it would have been worse for the Republican Party, and I think it would have been better for the country if there was somebody who was able to do that. Because Donald Trump, being the lodestar of the Republican Party, is so devastating to me as a conservative, but it should be so devastating to everybody as an American. Like, let's unshackle us from that and not, like, try to score some points in the midterm election because the Republicans are attached to a narcissistic idiot.
And you don't think, I mean, I kind of feel like Biden was trying to do what you just said. I mean, try to unshackle us from...
But again, they can never refrain from trying to point people who are pro-life as being undemocratic, when it's really the opposite. That's a fundamental, honest policy dispute. That's in one category. And the other category are, again, the people who are going to, like, try to stab Capitol Hill police on January 6th in the U.S. Capitol. Like, separate the line on that line. But the problem with that is that's 10% of Republicans versus 40%. He wants to try to draw off, you know, he wants to try to just get enough to win an election, and then he can't bring in regular old pro-lifers with him because that just pisses off the base, especially the donor base of his party.
Would you vote for me, Tim, if I were running on the left? Could I get you on board with a family values, welfarist left ticket?
Yeah, if it was you versus Donald Trump, yes. There were a couple of Republicans who I'd vote for over you. But, like,
well,
honestly,
yeah.
Like...
I'm not asking to steal Mitt Romney's vote from you.
Liz Bruni has declared her candidacy on left, right, and center.
Well, I just think part of it's how you treat people. Yeah, there we go. I'll knock out Manchin.
if you get to go against Manchin's, like, corporate welfare for all his donors, and you're the family values pro-life person, absolutely. I'm going to have the Liz Bruni sign in my front yard.
Well, we're actually going to talk to someone who has run for office recently in our next segment when we come back. So I'll be back with that special guest and Tim Carney and Elizabeth Brunig. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media and your center. On the left, we have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. On the right, Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Well, in a week when an American president is warning that our democracy may be at risk, we lost one of that democracy's admirers. Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the former Soviet Union, died this week. Now, one misconception about Gorbachev is he wanted the Soviet Union to fall. Actually, he believed in communism and wanted the Soviet Union to continue and thrive, but he did want the society to be more open. Gorbachev once said that while he didn't think America should spread consumerism around the world, he believed that America had to be, quote, the teacher of democracy, which echoed what President Biden said Thursday night, saying that America is an idea that is important in the world. Tim, Let me ask you, do we still, as the United States, play these kinds of roles? Are we the world's teacher of democracy in 2022?
Oh, I think we still are. And like, I'm a guy who's totally against the idea that we need to be spreading democracy. When you had either Bill Clinton or George W. Bush talking about how we need to use our military to spread this, I was totally against it. What Reagan was said perfectly, and this was a very sort of biblical Christian idea, was that we need to be this shining city on the hill. And that's absolutely our role and our duty, and we still do it. Like, we just had the worst moment in our democracy on January 6th, and I saw it firsthand, and we came out of it relatively bloodless. So I still do think, now,
there was a Capitol Police officer who died and several other police officers who,
again, relatively bloodless. We had a handful of people who died, horrible, and we're still the shining city on the hill. I think we have to be that. I think we are still that. I think it's under threat. But I really do think that other countries look to us. They look to our prosperity, our happiness, our diversity, our ideological diversity, and they see in us a model of what they could be, as this is what democracy and freedom could be.
Liz, you agree?
I mean, I think that America is, you know, it represents liberal democracy in a lot of ways around the world, and in ways that are not insignificant. Because as decayed as our liberal democracy might be at the moment, it is still significantly more advanced than a lot of countries that are struggling for forms of democratic representation in their government. And so I certainly believe that liberal democracy is what we've got. It's what we need to preserve. It's much better than a lot of the alternatives. It's certainly much better than the alternative we seem to be peeling towards. And it's certainly something that is worth at least a vote and at this point, a feeling. I don't know exactly how to recapture an emotion, a type of maybe patriotism or investment in a type of unity that feels shattered or maybe overly strained or something like that. But to me, that seems like the kind of course correction we need.
When Gorbachev died, I just kept thinking about that essay written by Francis Fukuyama, the political scientist, 1989, The End of History, which was, we were all taught, meant that, you know, largely liberal democracies and market economies were winning out. And here we are in 2022. Russia sure as hell doesn't have a real democracy. And amazingly, we're kind of in a conversation about the future of ours, which is just, I don't know, alarming. But I want to have that sort of optimism. But anyway, I do want to bring in a special guest who has been thinking a lot about this and has actually seen our democracy operating up close recently. Danielle Allen is a government professor at Harvard University and the director of the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Ethics. Professor Allen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, David. Great to be here. This is a great conversation.
Yeah. Well, let me start with just asking you what you thought of President Biden's words on Thursday night. I mean, talking a lot about democracy.
Well, I'm grateful that he made a statement about democracy. It is time, I believe, for us to have this conversation. At the same time, I think it is absolutely the case that it was a straightforward campaign stump speech. Lots of the times in our democracy, you know, we crave philosophy when what we get is politics. And that's for a reason. You know, in democracy, you do politics, and that's how you actually make things happen. And his job, as I read it, was really to try to keep Democratic voters as intensely engaged as possible. I would agree with the view that he did not actually give room for people who are, quote unquote, in his words, mainstream Republicans to come back. I don't think that label was helpful for making people space to come back who are not, you know, the ultra MAGA folks. And so in that regard, it really was a speech directed at core Democrats, maximizing turnout, motivating people by giving them a higher cause. And I think it succeeded in that regard.
So you jumped into politics yourself, running for the Democratic nomination for governor in Massachusetts last year, and you wrote later that it was a very effective form of therapy. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. It was the year of columnists jumping in. Nick Kristof as well. So welcome, Liz. Yeah. Go for it. You know, it's the age.
Yeah.
Exactly. You write, you write, you write. It makes no difference. Well, Liz's writing makes a difference. Tim's writing makes a difference. My writing didn't make a difference. So you reach a point of frustration. And in my own particular case, I had some clear views about things that I thought could be better in Massachusetts. And so I jumped in. And it was really restorative in the sense that you just have this incredible opportunity to talk with people all over the Commonwealth. This beautiful thing happens. It's an extraordinary thing. You go visit with people. You are Jane Doe off the street. You know, I had almost zero name recognition. And all you say is, I'm running to be your next governor. People will tell you what is heavy on their hearts. They will hand to you their cares and burdens. And they have a deep faith in the notion that somebody can come in and make a difference on their behalf. So for me, it was just really discovering, for all that we talk about distrust and cynicism, our faith in our constitutional democracy and its institutions runs deep. That was very restorative.
You know, I was struck because when you wrote about the experience in the Washington Post, you described seeing this resilience in people, in local organizations, you know, and an ability for them to respond to big challenges like a pandemic. And I kept thinking, like, is that an endorsement of our system of government, or is it an indictment if people have to fend for themselves in that way and can't count on their elected officials to hear what's in their heart, as you're saying, to do something about it?
I really think it's both and, David. So yes, you're right. I mean, that was the other real source of hope and restorative experience for me. You know, here I was in a state where we had a completely flummoxed vaccine rollout, poor planning, poor logistics, leaving elderly people in long lines, vaccine sites at great distance from people in rural areas and things like that. And what turned the tide on vaccine distribution was local civil society organizations coming together, making a better plan, banging at the door of the government until they could get the vaccines and then delivering. And the truth of the matter is, this country has always been powered by that civil society ingenuity. And that is one of the truths of the resiliency of our democracy, for sure. In the pandemic, the ideal thing would have been a straightforward, upfront, from the beginning partnering between the public sector and civil society organizations in that way. In this instance, you know, civil society organizations had to really bang at the door to get the government to pay any attention to them. And that's kind of, you know, where our problem lies.
So that sounds like a mixed bag answer. I mean, it's, you still have belief in a democracy, but you saw a lot of failures in your state and elsewhere.
Yeah, institutional failures.
Well, Liz, as we've learned on the show, is considering a run for office. Liz, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
I wonder, Danielle, like, would you advise people like Liz or people who are seriously considering, you know, getting into politics in this moment? I mean, would you tell people, yeah, it's a great idea? Would you tell them to stay as far away as possible or somewhere in between?
No, 100%. I say, run, Liz, run. You know, go for it.
Liz, how is this landing with you, listening to Danielle and her experiences?
Oh, I mean, I'm really glad she had a good experience. I think, you know, I've had similar experiences as a reporter. When you show up and you say, you know, I'm impartial, I'm just interested in the truth, people will also tell you everything that's going on with them. I think in many ways being a sort of, you know, sort of dissident and independent person politically has made people in the United States even more willing to talk to me about politics in the last few years, because most people at this point are pretty frustrated, it seems, with partisanship. So
I've had the same experience as Liz of just going around the country and just, you walk into a bar, whether it's in, you know, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, or, you know, rural Texas, and you just sit down and you can't ever say, as the first thing, I'm a political reporter, I want your views on politics. So then they just say politics is BS and they shut up. But if the third question is, so like, what do you think of our governor? What do you think of our president? What do you think of the economy? Soon they start talking about very like sophisticated ideas of what they're dissatisfied with. And a lot of it is cultural. I think our media leaves out the cultural stuff. We focus on the economics and the politics. But it really is my experience that sitting down, and I'll admit, like, the third question in some bar that's, you know, 100% union liberal in the middle of New York City or whatever, I'll say, hey, I'm a conservative, but this is my perspective. And people are really willing to have that discussion because there's a shared idea that there are frustrations, there are problems, and our political system isn't solving it. I've envied politicians because my job is to go into bars and talk to these people, and I have to submit these expense reports, and these politicians, that's all they do 24/7. I'd love that job.
Yeah, but I mean, I just listen, and I've been in those bars too, and I've loved those experiences. And Tim, like, it's almost like I feel like we're living in two different worlds. It's the world where, you know, we're talking about Biden's speech, and Fox News has the banner saying that this is the most shameful moment of Biden's presidency, and then there's the bar that we could all be sitting at and having a conversation over some beers with people who might really be talking about their communities and, like, giving a someone running for office ideas about how they might change it. I mean, that disconnect feels dangerous. All right, talking to Tim Carney, also Danielle Allen and Elizabeth Brunig, and we'll be back. We're going to talk about whether the biggest threat to our democracy is actually social media. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we are back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, David Green, coming to you from the center. On the right, we have Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. And our special guest is Danielle Allen. She is a government professor at Harvard University and director of the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Ethics. Danielle, I want to dig a little into social media because you wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently about how social media, and you called out Facebook in particular, has really undermined our constitutional democracy as it was designed. I mean, you talked about a system that was meant to prevent extremist views from taking hold because of the vast geography of our country. But can you explain a little bit more about what you're talking about?
Sure, happy to. So, you know, we're all so fed up with politics these days. I mean, you sort of hear that all over the
place.
From
everybody, yeah.
Exactly. But we're not by any means the first era of American history to feel that way. And that sort of feeling was pervasive even at the time of the founding. Nothing was working. You know, Congress couldn't get a quorum after the Revolution using the Articles of Confederation. They couldn't pass a budget. They couldn't pay war debts and so forth. You know, massive frustration, economic problems and so forth. That's what led to the writing of the Constitution. And one of the problems the Constitution was supposed to solve for was what in the 18th century, they called factionalism. It's sort of really basically what we now call polarization or tribalism. Mm-hmm. And so the design of the Constitution was really intended to, you know, make representation work, get the people's voice into politics, but also in a way that put a brake on extremism. And very often we focus on the fact that they didn't design a direct democracy where people just sort of show up to an assembly like in ancient Greece or something like that, and everybody's kind of going at it. Instead, they designed a system of representation, and the representatives were supposed to filter opinion and the like. But that was really only half of what the idea was. And the other half, as articulated by Madison in the Federalist Papers, was that the very breadth of the republic, so that's his vocabulary, broad republic, the geographic dispersal of the citizenry would be part of what made it all work. Because people with extreme views would have trouble finding each other. The only way they could get their views into public would be to go through those representatives. So geography was, in effect, a forcing factor that was supposed to make representation work. It was an actual premise of the design of the Constitution. So our media ecosystem has obviously changed massively over the centuries, and every big transformation, radio, TV, and so forth, has had an impact. But social media really is just a qualitatively different kind of impact because it just knocked that premise of geographic dispersal out from under us. So now, you know, folks can find each other, you know, all over the globe with extreme views. And some of the extremism we're seeing in this country isn't just limited to this country. As you know, it's sort of globally networked and the like. And so given that change, we have to really reckon with the fact that this sort of whole architecture of our representative system has been made unstable by the removal of that premise of geographic dispersal.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you have proposed some pretty significant changes to our government. I mean, increasing the size of the House of Representatives, reintroduction of districts with multiple members. One of the ideas that you brought up was an idea that is actually being used in some elections today, which we want to talk about in Alaska, but it's the idea of ranked choice voting. First, what does that mean, and why would that help solve the problem you're talking about?
So the target of the work in designing the Constitution was representation.
Right.
How to make representation work so that you can hear the voice of the people and have it be driven towards effective problem solving, right? That's kind of like, that's the design challenge that we collectively face. So one of the things that was supposed to help was geography, you know, because again, it broke up the sort of most extreme views and the like. We don't have that anymore. So in that regard, we've got to kind of rethink how we design the basic institutions of representation to achieve those goals of voice for the people and effective problem solving. And so the recommendations come from the work of a commission run by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So increasing the size of the House, ranked choice voting, multi-member districts. Say more in a minute about why those things should make a difference. But I also want to say none of these ideas are actually new. They're all old ideas. They're pieces of, you know, design that got put aside at various points in time. For the first century of the country's life, the House increased every 10 years. It wasn't until the early 20th century, in a moment of kind of complicated politics, they just kind of
gave up. People are dusting these off and saying, we've got problems, let's bring out some ideas that seem to maybe work as the country was evolving.
Congress was always supposed to change in its size and shape with the demography of the country. So, and you need that in order to keep in balance the sort of dynamic relationship between urban and rural areas and things like that. So why ranked choice voting? What is it and why would it help? And, you know, what did we just see in Alaska?
Yeah.
You know, so ranked choice voting is when you have, in effect, instant runoff. When you go to the polls, you vote for your first choice and your second choice and your third choice. If, when you take that first count, nobody gets over 50%, you knock out the bottom people, and everybody who voted for them, their votes get reallocated to their second choice.
And Sarah Palin just lost the race to Mary Peltola, we should say a Democrat, in an election run with this very idea in Alaska.
Exactly.
For
exactly.
House seat,
this is,
yeah.
The same method that was used, you know, the other Republican Party in Virginia used it, and that resulted in Glenn Youngkin's surprising choice as nominee in that gubernatorial race, for example. You know, and in some sense, again, it's an old idea. You know, you go back to the conventions of the middle of the 19th century, the convention when Lincoln became the nominee. It took multiple ballots before you got to a nominee because nobody got over that 50% threshold. And so, you know, ranked choice voting is just a much faster, more efficient way of doing multiple ballots to make sure somebody gets over that 50% threshold.
Sarah Palin and other Republicans are basically saying that Alaska vote disenfranchised the majority of voters who wanted a Republican, and some are calling it a scam fraud election. Tim, what do you think of ranked choice voting in general and how it played out in Alaska? I mean, obviously, Democrats are celebrating at the moment. Republicans are saying it's unfair. But what do you make of it?
I mean, so this is the beauty of federalism, right? Is we get to try this experiment at many different levels in many different ways. In New York City, Mayor Adams got elected. And there was a moment where we thought, wait, he might finish first in the first ballot and not get it. And he ended up finishing first in the first ballot and still winning. And then in this case, most of the voters in Alaska wanted a Republican, but they couldn't agree on what Republican they wanted. And in the end, a majority of them, when forced to choose, two out of three chose a Democrat. I don't know whether this is a good idea. This is the beauty of federalism. Like, I think a lot of the problem with our ruling class today is that they really think they know what's best. So let's try this out. I know in my own county that I just moved out of. I used to live in Montgomery County, Maryland. I moved out because they have a terrible county executive. Absolutely horrible. Twice he got elected with like 35 and 40%, by less than 100% each time. There is no way he would have won with ranked choice voting. So part of it is my own experience of like going from Montgomery County, where I'm this conservative guy with the competent liberal governance, to totally incompetent governance by this dude, Mark Elrich. And I'm like, huh, there's no way he would have won with ranked choice voting. That's my saying, I think it's worth a try. I'm not convinced, but I think Danielle's right that like American experiment needs lots of different rejuvenations. And the beauty of federalism, of letting different localities and states try different things, is we can see, oh, wait, maybe this is a big mistake or maybe this is a great idea.
Liz, what do you think of this kind of experimentation with the way, I mean, with some of these, you know, not insignificant things like increasing the size of the House and expanding ranked choice voting to more of the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like a good idea. I don't know, ranked choice voting, in a lot of other liberal democracies, and I think France is the obvious example, they have ranked choice voting, they'll have runoff elections. I mean, there are a lot of things you can do to make democracies more sensitive and sort of more able to interact with the ways that people actually make choices, which are not always these sort of binary one-off choices, but often have to do with, you know, ranking your choices or, you know, it coming down to two other candidates and then making a choice based on that. I think moving in the direction of a more parliamentary system, frankly, and away from this two-party duopoly, as Ralph Nader calls it, that we've been in for such a long time, is another great move. And maybe expanding the size of the House would bring us a step closer to that, or maybe I can just dream, who knows. But I mean, I'm up for tinkering with the way the democracy is structured. Other liberal democracies try it all different kinds of ways, and they seem to have different levels of success, all comparable in you know, the developed world. So why not?
Do we think there's a risk here in, and I don't, I love the idea of experimenting and seeing what works and what doesn't, but does this sort of experimentation take attention away from some of the deeper problems, like lack of faith in elections at all, or extremist views, or the ability of someone like Donald Trump to be a force that, who draws the love and appeal of so many people and can draw them into a movement that is incredibly dangerous for the country? Like, does it take our eye off the ball in some way by focusing on tinkering?
It does not take our eye off the ball. And tinkering can be very profound and important. At the end of the day, the way to defeat people who are against democracy is to make sure that democracy is worthy of the love of a supermajority of American citizens. For our democracy to be worthy of our love, it's got to work. It's just that basic. And, you know, there's all kinds of evidence from around the world, for example, that if you have a dysfunctional democracy and you spend a lot of effort increasing participation in that democracy, sort of driving up turnout, encouraging people to vote and so forth, and then the election goes off and it is as either corrupt or results in nothing as previously, you end up with more cynicism at the end than at the beginning. So at the end of the day, you know, democracy's got to work. It's got to be responsive. People have to feel heard, and it's got to be effective. So that's what the American people deserve. And we've got to do that work so that a supermajority of American people, despite their good faith policy differences, can get on board and say, yes, I love my country. Here's why. And I get why democracy is good for people.
I guess I go back to the Biden speech on Thursday night in Philadelphia. And I just think about, you know, we've talked a lot on this show about belief in democracy, you know, a lot of it being emotional. It comes from, you know, a place in your heart. I'm just trying to figure out, like, whether I left that speech having that belief, like having that optimism. I mean, I left feeling really kind of nervous and down and like, this sucks.
I think what you registered is that speech was fundamentally a political speech. And that's okay. Like, this is the first day of the campaign season. People give political speeches. There's a different kind of speech that would be doing different work. This was not the occasion for that speech. But I think if you were hoping for that speech, then you would have left, yes, I think, feeling disappointed, because the work we have to do together is harder than the speech conveyed. You know, there's more to be said about how you actually draw a line between the extremists who wear MAGA hats and then other people who also wear MAGA hats who aren't extremists. You know, and I don't think the label mainstream Republicans actually captures those people or gives them a space to come back to. we have to be actually honest about who those people are, what they care about, if we're going to be able to have the true conversation about what we're arguing about in the country. So that's the moral work, is like right there in that space. And that's not what this speech was about. This was a political speech. It was about saying, Democrats, here's the higher cause you're working for. Stay with me. Be strong. We have enough numbers. If we stay strong in the cause we're for, we can do it in November. That's what the speech was for. That's what it did. It did its job as it was supposed to.
I mean, Tim, this goes back to a point that you made, like, who is the right person for this moment? I kind of wonder, like, is that what we're missing? Like, someone to rise to the level of being able to guide this country through this moment. And I don't think Biden was the right person for this moment. And that was not the right speech.
Theoretically, he was, but the duopoly that Liz referred to earlier is a problem here, you couldn't have become the nominee if you were going to buck the party establishment too much. As I think in normal times, you need, you know, it's fine to have a Reagan and a Bush followed by a Clinton followed by a Bush followed by an Obama. And then are we going out of regular times where we actually need a Lincoln? And that's a question at hand. And Biden's not that guy. Biden's a guy who kind of was inoffensive to the Democrats and could hold on, but isn't going to stand up to anybody either. He's not going to stand up to anybody in his party and in the way that he has to. Biden doesn't have the fight in him. And yeah.
Liz, do you see the fight?
No. And I think that, you know, you obviously need this speech. I mean, you know, it's clear, I think, to everyone that liberal democracy itself worldwide is a little bit on the ropes. And American democracy in particular seems to be encountering some problems. You know, in my view, you need the speech. You need people to take American democracy seriously. You need them to want it. I'm skeptical that regulating the social media platforms is going to be all that successful, because I've seen the radicalization keep pace, not with the major social media platforms, but just with the size of the internet. There's no way to stop it.
I'd love to jump in on that point for a second, because that's exactly why the institutional reforms are so important. The problems that have come our way thanks to social media, we don't fix them by regulating the platforms. We fix them by redesigning our institutions to do the same kind of work to proof them against extremism that geographic dispersal used to do.
I'm interested in this theory. I'm also an extremist. And so I'm skeptical of it. I too would like to link up with like-minded socialists and create a welfare state in the United States, which is an extremist view in American politics. There's no party that represents us, even. We're an extremist wing, maybe sometimes, of an extant party, but more often not, we have no party, and we're extremely small in numbers. So I'm skeptical of guards against extremism writ large. However, I agree with the problems represented by types of extremism that are negative, such as the sort of right-wing extremism bordering on fascism. So, you know, hopefully at some point we pass this inflection point. Maybe, you know, material problems will recede such that people will get lulled back into whatever they're doing when it's not being agitated. But right now they are agitated.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank Professor Danielle Allen from Harvard University. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us. It was great having you.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
All right, we have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants, bringing you pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, I will give you the soapbox first.
The New York Mets just took two of three games from the league-leading Los Angeles Dodgers. On Wednesday night, Mets pitcher Jacob deGrom was dominant and center fielder Brandon Nimmo saved the game with a full-speed leaping catch to rob the Dodgers of a home run. It was a couple of perfect nights for the Mets fans like me, in part because it assured us that we could beat the Dodgers come playoff time. But let's stop that line of thought right there, okay? Don't think about October. Relish the moment.
It's easy to worry about who will be healthy in the postseason or how we would match up with the Astros in the World Series or if we'll blow our division lead again. But this is the path to unhappiness. The only way to be a happy Mets fan is to love the great moments as they come and let tomorrow worry about itself. And so, once again, baseball becomes a metaphor for life. Plan for the future, yes, but don't let your worries about tomorrow cloud your enjoyment of today.
Elizabeth Brunig.
Coming up on Labor Day weekend, hope everybody enjoys it and thanks the U.S. labor movement. Take some time to read the NLRA, think about your local union, and buy Made in America union-made products.
Okay, short and sweet. Okay, my rant, I'm taking us back to Pennsylvania, where President Biden spoke this week and where I was born and where the Senate race is just getting super ugly. Dr. Oz, you should be ashamed of yourself. I am talking about the Republican nominee. He's running against Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who is recovering from a stroke. Fetterman has declined to take part in a debate next week. Oz's campaign thought it was really cute to release some mock concessions they would offer to get their opponent there, including the freedom to take bathroom breaks. They also offered to provide additional medical personnel at the debate. You are disgusting. That is not funny. You want to raise Fetterman's medical record as a campaign issue, Dr. Oz? That is fair, but find a way to do it gracefully and with respect. As for this insulting approach, all it shows is that you are not fit for office. That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank Tim Carney, Elizabeth Brunig, and our guest, Danielle Allen. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Alexandra Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I am David Green. We appreciate you joining us and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.